Hello and welcome to Moaz. Human rights. They allow us to find work, live safely, move freely, and importantly, to be treated equally. But who defends them when they're threatened? In this podcast, we're speaking to people working to defend the human rights of refugees and migrants, identifying violations and protecting those uncovering abuses. Migrants and refugees are entitled to rights and protections while on the move, but as Christian Friis Bach, Secretary General for the Danish Refugee Council, says, human rights and state obligations to those rights are under pressure. At the height of the EU-Turkey deal in 2015, the EU created temporary places known as hotspots. These were places where migrants would stay until their asylum applications were processed. One of those locations was the Moria camp in Lesvos, Greece. 2 years on from its opening, reports from the camps listed a series of human rights violations committed against its residents. For a space built for 1,800 people, the camp was housing almost four times that many. Christian Friis Bach explains more about DRC's findings.
That study was based primarily on our presence in the camps, where we are present in the Moria camp with a protection team that on a daily basis witness the protection violations seen in the camp and also witness the conditions under which migrants and refugees in the camps are living and how they are treated and the access of basic dignity and the access of basic respect also for their rights within the camp. So it is from our part and in the cooperation that we did the report, it's based on our presence in the camp and also on our regular visits to the camp by various other officials of the Danish Refugee Council who on a regular basis, of course, visit our team in the camp and by themselves witness and see how the condition in the camp is developing.
What does the Moria Asylum Centre tell us about the EU's hotspot approach and if it upholds human rights?
I do not believe that the conditions in the Moria camp lives up to basic human rights. I believe that we, both refugees and asylum seekers, experience a broad range of right violations when they arrive to the hotspots, in Greece at least, and the lack of legal assistance, the lack of identification of vulnerable persons, the restricted freedom, the lack of protection, not least of women and girls, constituting human rights violations. And they are severe issues, and we have for long called for the European countries, the European Commission, and for the hosting countries of the hotspots to strengthen the conditions and improve the conditions in the camp and the protection of those who are staying in the camps. And this is what the report also tried to address. And it was a call for action to make sure that we do not see further human rights violations on European soil of refugees and migrants arriving in the hotspots. There are severe problems. I've been there myself in Moria, and there are severe protection gaps, and the safety and security of the people in the camp are not properly protected, not least of the women and girls. I believe the latest numbers from UNHCR showed that one-fourth of all sexual violations of women and girls, all the women and girls that have faced sexual violations, one-fourth of those cases are actually happening in the camp, which is, of course, unacceptable, and the police is not providing proper protection. The housing conditions are not adequate or safe and secure. And also here you see a number of severe violations happening on European soil without proper action being taken. And it's not acceptable, it's not dignified, and it's not living up to basic human rights.
Defending human rights isn't simply reserved for large organizations like the United Nations. Human rights defenders are also individuals and sometimes even victims of violations themselves. To get the message out about abuses, they risk their lives and often face the consequences. The NGO Frontline Defenders believes they need protecting too. Erin Kilbride is the Media and Visibility Coordinator for the Irish NGO, which started in 2001. It supports HRDs at risk through a range of support from profile raising to protection grants and respite.
So human rights defenders are people who work non-violently to protect the rights of their communities. And so the human rights defenders that we support are working on a really wide variety of different types of human rights issues and violations. So this ranges from people who are protecting the rights of the LGBTI communities in various different contexts, people working on land and environment or indigenous people's rights, on good governance, on elections monitoring, on freedom from torture, a really wide variety of things. So we work with defenders who are working on all of these issues. Again, our focus is on security and protection, not on any one particular human rights area. And I think it's also important to say here that HRDs are certainly not just people who work formally in NGOs or in civil society organizations, not by a long shot. Definitely those are HRDs. But when we say it, we're also talking about indigenous community leaders, farmers, teachers, journalists, bloggers, mothers, a wide range of people who are organizing their communities to protect their rights. And I mean, that is something that's explicitly laid out in the declaration, but it's also really kind of important to us as an organization that we're working with people who, it's about the work that they do, right? It's not about the title or whether or not they have a business card that says they're a human rights lawyer.
What kinds of challenges do you face trying to protect HRDs?
So, I mean, the first would definitely be that we are an organization that's focused on security and protection. So in all things that we do, we never want our work to put someone more at risk. That being said, defenders do an element of choosing risk, right? Deciding to go on TV in Bangladesh right now and denounce the government's very aggressive crackdown on student protesters, right? Deciding to be the face of criticizing the government's lethal response to these protests, that's dangerous, and human rights defenders have chosen to do it anyway. So we also have to take in, you know, there's a bit of a balance there, right? Between we don't want to put people more at risk, but insofar as they have chosen to do that work despite that risk, we want to support them in that. So in addition to restrictive legislation, we are very cognizant of things like demonization of human rights defenders who work abroad. Again, you get that either official foreign agent label or agent of the West or Western backed or that sort of thing is common pretty much everywhere in the world. Communication with defenders can also be tricky. So if you think of an area like, I think you've been doing a few podcasts recently on Rohingya. And so if you think of an area like Rakhine State, where for decades the government has worked to ensure that limited information can get in or out, what does that mean for us as an organization that wants to support human rights defenders on the ground? It's all well and good to say journalists from the UK are trying to get into Rakhine, but the international community needs the expertise of defenders who have been there for decades documenting that information, right? But if we can't communicate with them, how do we find out what they need? And this is also true for HRDs in other remote areas, right? So even if it isn't something where the military is explicitly blocking off a community, you also have situations where defenders in kind of remote areas or from very rural or indigenous communities don't have access to certain types of communication. So the emergency protection grants form on our website enables defenders to fill out a form that is sent to us encrypted, so it is secure. However, if they don't have access to the internet or smartphone, encrypted communication is all well and good, but how are we going to communicate with these HRDs who don't have access to a phone? Smear campaigns, again, just to go back to the defamation issue, are a huge one. This could be from a corporation, a government, state-aligned media, and this is one of those places where the risks that HRDs face are not always so tangible, the ones that have to do with reputation or community ties or strain on families. I think we're continuously thinking about how to work so that we are reaching the most at-risk defenders, and again, the ones who may not have access to kind of mainstream networks or types of communications. So for example, if you're working in a country where LGBT groups, and this is true in most countries in the world, where LGBT organizations have been historically marginalized from more mainstream civil society networks, then we have to be quite intentional about doing outreach with these groups, because if we only go through the mainstream networks in the capital, for example, if historically LGBT work has been kept out of these spaces, then we won't be reaching those defenders. And even when we do, we won't necessarily understand their unique needs.
If the evidence suggests genocide or crimes against humanity, should we wait for someone else to make the call? Fortify Rights is an independent rights organization that supports local human rights defenders, while also investigating violations and influencing political players to act. In the context of the recent Rohingya crisis, their painstaking research has helped them show the world how the Myanmar military prepared and executed its crackdown on the Rohingya. Matt Smith is the CEO and co-founder, and he tells us more.
First and foremost, collecting information is key. In our documentation of human rights violations, we aim to get as close as possible to the violations that are occurring. So we're speaking with survivors, eyewitnesses, government officials, in some cases perpetrators of human rights violations, and we're collecting firsthand testimony from those people. Firsthand information is critical. So when a human rights violation happens, often there are many people in the community who know what happened. And in their mind, they have knowledge of it. And they do have knowledge of it. But the key is to locate eyewitnesses and survivors who have firsthand knowledge. And so we go about that process. We carefully document testimony they provide. But I just want to emphasize that our documentation philosophy doesn't regard eyewitnesses and survivors as sources of information. Rather, they're more like participants in the truth-telling process. So the way that we document testimony is really intended to empower members of the community that we're working with. They're in charge in many ways. And of course, it's an entirely voluntary process. But in terms of establishing the facts and in terms of understanding what exactly has taken place, it's really important for us as a human rights organization to always corroborate and triangulate information. If there are, say, 7 people from a village of 5,000 who we spoke to, who all witnessed the same incident from different vantage points, and they all describe similar or the same details, in a situation like that, we grow more confident. We would regard that as corroboration. Triangulating data, that refers to ensuring we have at least 3 sources on any one claim. This is very important. We never want to put information out into the world that we're not 100% confident is accurate. The truth is essential to human rights documentation. But in terms of producing the reports, this is all just the first stage. So once we collect the information, we store it it's a database. It's a qualitative data analyzer, actually. So this helps us make sense of the data. It's a way to organize the testimony, and it helps us write it up in an easier way. We don't just share the information that we collect. We analyze it in the framework of international law. So what we're trying to do really is collect firsthand information, collect evidence, also including photographs and video, and then analyze it in the context of the law to determine what specific violations have occurred, what crimes have been committed, and of course, in the case of our most recent report, who specifically is or may be responsible for those crimes. Once we have a draft of the report written, we tend to go through a very exhaustive vetting process. So typically we'll engage outside reviewers, and these would be people outside of our organization who would be in a position to critically review the work. And we have a very thorough internal quality control process we use really just to make sure that we're not making any errors. And then at that point, assuming we've all survived that very lengthy process, we hand it over to our design specialist, Yuri, who takes it all and puts it into a compelling format that will help us more effectively communicate the information to audiences.
In terms of declaring a situation a human rights violation, a crime against humanity, or a genocide, do you independently make those calls on your own evidence, or do you await a response from a higher international mechanism to declare it?
Well, it's interesting. It's a great question. For some reason, genocide is the lone crime that people tend to suggest some sort of higher authority needs to declare it before we can all be comfortable with the term. We disagree with that notion. Making legal determinations with regard to human rights violations is not the exclusive domain of the International Criminal Court. It's not the exclusive domain of international lawyers or human rights experts. Members of the Rohingya community, and in this particular case, members of the Rohingya community can and should analyze the situation and make their own judgments and make their own determinations about what's going on. So from our perspective, as an independent human rights organization, we collect the information and we make our own legal determinations. So we analyze the facts in the framework of international human rights and international criminal law, and then we make determinations based on that. In doing so, we do on occasion work closely with other organizations or law firms. For example, on our most recent report, we worked closely with a team of lawyers from Covington and Burling, which is a large international law firm, and they provided their own legal analysis to the facts that we had established. That's very helpful. In 2015, we did a project with a team from Yale Law School led by Professor Jim Silk. And that was a process in which the team from Yale took some of our information and analyzed it in the context of the law. But in terms of going back to your original question, we don't have to wait for a response from a higher international mechanism to determine if the crimes that are being perpetrated constitute genocide or crimes against humanity. It's all of our responsibility to take a look at what's happening and try to make accurate determinations based on the facts.
So we found that defending human rights isn't a role solely for large rights organizations like UNHCR to do. Even individuals are risking their lives to tell the world about abuses. And it's not simply about uncovering them. It's also about getting that painstaking work to the right tables and agendas of change makers. A body of evidence has been gathered since August last year, and much of it shows human rights abuses and atrocities tantamount to genocide against the Rohingya. The question is now, will they receive justice through the International Criminal Court? If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can also follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can donate to help us help Rohingya refugees. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.